More than 4 months after Russia first invaded Ukraine at the end of February, the war is still grinding forward. Some of Russia's latest strikes have targeted cities in southern and central Ukraine, the latest being the southern city of Mykolaiv, where, according to local officials and reported by the New York Times, Russian missiles hit two universities, a hotel, and a mall. Here's Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in a video address posted to his website yesterday. He started the address saying he's speaking not to Ukrainians, but to the country's democratic partners. He demands Russia be officially declared a terrorist state.
Жодна інша держава світу не дозволяє собі щоденно знищувати крилатими ракетами і реактивною артилерією мирні міста і звичайне людське життя.
Translating here, no other state in the world, he said, allows itself to destroy peaceful cities and ordinary human life with cruise missiles and rocket artillery every day. We're going to be talking about the state of the war in Ukraine, how effective Western support has been, and whether it can hold out much longer. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about where things stand with the war? Do you think the U.S. and its allies have done enough to help Ukraine and to punish Russia? What more would you like to see them do, if anything? And what questions do you have about the wartime goals of Russia, Ukraine, and the situation on the ground right now? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lowell Barrington is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. He's also a research affiliate with UW-Madison's Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia. Lowell, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Dean. It's great to be back on.
Good to have you. As I mentioned in the intro, some recent Russian attacks in central and southern Ukraine. Where is the majority of fighting happening right now?
Well, we're 4.5 months into the war, and as you might remember, the initial assault that was really in a few different places but had focused on Kyiv and went very badly for Russia has led them to focus initially more on the south and southeast, and then most recently really in the far east of Ukraine in the areas of Luhansk and Donetsk, what's known as the Donbass region. And that had been going better for them, certainly than some of the earlier parts of the conflict. But it is interesting to see these missile strikes, especially really over the last month, where they have been hitting areas that are far from the central areas of fighting right now for them, including the attack earlier this week in Vinnytsia. That's actually in kind of west central Ukraine. It was a pretty long strike away from where the fighting is mostly going on right now.
And what do you attribute that to, those attacks in more civilian areas?
Well, this isn't new. Russia has been hitting areas that have been civilian targets, at least according to the Ukraine and the West, for much of the war. But there were times when they would do that and times when they'd back off. And one theory about it not happening for a while was they were actually running low on the kinds of precision missiles they were trying to use. But in the last month or so, seem to have done that more frequently. So that's one possibility. The other is that Ukraine has had some success in the last week or two, in particular, thanks to some of the new weapons they're using from the United States and Europe in the east. And this may be something where Russia is also sort of lashing out a bit in terms of things not going quite as well in the east in the last week.
In that far eastern part of Ukraine, is there much territory changing hands right now between Russia and Ukraine?
The changes are not real swift right now. Russia had been making kind of incremental gains in a few key cities and things, for example, up to a week or so ago. Ukraine has had some success actually in the southern part of the country, and in the area around Kherson, for example. They have actually pushed Russia out of a number of settlements or smaller towns and things in that area. So they've had some successes there, but it is largely been kind of a bit of a stalemate for the last week or so in the east, at least.
We're talking with Lowell Barrington right now, associate professor of political science at Marquette University, an expert on Eastern Europe and Russia, talking about the latest in the war in Ukraine. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones now. We have Nick with us in La Crosse. Hi, Nick.
Hello.
What was on your mind?
When this war started, and it was evident that the Ukrainians were going to fight and the Russians were in trouble, we've sort of given them, if we weren't going to provide troops, which was off the table, we sort of provided them heavy arms right from the beginning. And I wrote a letter to the La Crosse Tribune that was published stating that the West was going to have blood on their hands. And they have a lot of blood on their hands because they never acted forcefully from the beginning.
Nick, thanks for the call. Lowell, what do we know about the support that the U.S. has given Ukraine militarily up to this point and right now?
Well, Nick's point is an interesting one, and I will agree to a certain extent in that we had not focused initially in our aid packages on some of the heavy artillery and some of the newer, higher-tech heavy artillery that they are now receiving. But some of that had to do with the way that the Russians were fighting. That was not a central priority in some ways for the Ukrainians. They were much better off early on using many of the things that we had supplied them, including the Javelin anti-tank weapons that they were very successful with early on, the Stinger anti-helicopter things, some of the drone things that they've been using that we've supplied them. And I think it's also important to say, we gave them a lot of the really nuts and bolts basics of artillery rounds and, you know, millions of rounds of small ammunition, tens of thousands of body armor and helmets, and, you know, things that they really needed early on as well. But one of the other challenges, the bigger and the kind of more powerful the equipment, the longer it takes to get it there and the harder it is to transport it to where Ukraine needs it in the battlefield. So some of this has been a timing issue. The new HIMARS systems, which have been really effective, they are mobile, but you also, when you get them into the country, initially some of these larger things can be a bit more visible, and there was a fear that, you know, again, Russia might be targeting these more effectively, some of these bigger heavy artillery systems, so that was slowing down things as well a bit. So I think it's fair to say we didn't give them heavy arms early on, but it would be a mistake to jump from that to the idea that we have not been providing a lot of support.
And has that support made a measurable effect on the battlefield, do you think?
Well, it's made a huge effect, again, early on in the initial attack on Kyiv, for example. The Ukrainians were really successful with attacking the lines and sort of columns of tanks and other vehicles and things that the Russians were using. The losses by Russia of tanks alone, I mean, not to mention the soldiers, which is another really just amazing number and kind of tragic thing for Russia right now. But, I mean, the estimates are that Russia's lost about 1,500 tanks so far. Ukraine has captured a lot of these and been able to use them. So one of the strange statistics, they have a whole part of their military, for example, that is essentially a bunch of mechanics that fix up these Russian tanks and send them back out for the Ukrainians to use. And one of the interesting statistics is that Ukraine actually has more tanks now than it did at the start of the army, start of the war. Sorry, this army has, you know, seized so many tanks and things that it's got more tanks than they had at the beginning. And there was a joke going around about one of the things that's been happening is that farmers have actually been capturing some of these tanks that have been damaged or abandoned. And, you know, you see these videos of Ukrainian farmers are dragging these tanks down the road with their tractors. And the joke was that Ukrainian farmers had become the fifth largest army in the world. And that's not true. But if you had the sort of took the number of tanks they'd captured, it was something like the 35th largest army in terms of tanks, you know, just that Ukrainian farmers had captured. So, again, I think they've had a lot of successes. And the part of the war we're in now has been more challenging. This is where Russia has turned toward just a real use of constant artillery bombardment, you know, again, not being very discriminating between civilians and military targets. And that has required Ukraine to try to switch to some of these more long-range and larger artillery attack systems.
What do we know about Vladimir Putin's goals at this point, how they may have changed, and what he could see as an acceptable outcome?
Well, boy, that's the tough question. I mean, I can say certainly his approach changed in the sense that early on they really thought they could get the capital, Kyiv, in relatively short order. I think there's a pretty good understanding that the thought on the Russian side was it might be a week or 2 weeks and they would have control of Kyiv, and that clearly did not happen. So at that point, there seemed to be two ways that Putin's focus changed. One was to make sure they got control of as much of the south, and in particular the Black Sea coast, as possible. And then the other thing was to now then move the fighting back into the Far East, which had been an area of fighting, obviously, ongoing since 2014, on and off. This is not a brand new war there. But Russia has really focused its attention on the east and again, has succeeded, for example, in largely getting full control of the entire region of Luhansk right now through some of its successes in the last few weeks.
We're talking with Lowell Barrington, associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University, affiliate with UW-Madison Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia. We're talking about the latest in the war on Ukraine, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you continued to follow updates out of Ukraine? Have you had difficulty following the ongoing war as it's faded a bit in the news? What questions do you have about U.S. and Western support? Is it something you'd like to see continue and the U.S. continue to stand behind financially, militarily? Where do you think the war is going? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter. We continue our talk with Marquette University's Lowell Barrington. We're looking at the effectiveness and endurance of Western support for Ukraine in its war against the Russian invasion. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. If you have thoughts about how the war is going, questions about what it will take to reach a conclusion, call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Lowell, just in the last week, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson resigned, and he was an early and a very staunch advocate for backing Ukraine militarily, financially. What impact do you think his resignation could have on support from the West?
That's a really important question. I think the real short answer is, so far it looks like the support from the UK is going to continue, even as a replacement Prime Minister comes into position in the UK. But I don't want to downplay his role. He and President Biden actually both should receive much more credit, I think, than they both have in really leading this very united Western stance against Russia in this conflict, and you know, getting the UK and Germany and France together on the same page on things is not always easy. And Johnson, you're right, was very forceful. He traveled to Kyiv multiple times, and even to the point where there are towns in Ukraine that have been discussing changing street names to name them for Boris Johnson. I mean, this is something where in Ukraine he's an incredibly popular figure because of how, again, as you said, early and strong his support for Ukraine was. But again, I think the some of the leading figures that are looking to be kind of potential contenders, at least to take over for Johnson, include Liz Truss, who's the foreign secretary, and Ben Wallace is the defense secretary. And both of them have been, you know, again, very vocal and very strong in their support of Ukraine against Russia. So I think in the grand scheme of things, it won't change a lot. But Ukraine and President Zelensky in particular were certainly not happy to see Boris Johnson's resignation announcement.
We'll go next to the phones. We have Glenn with us on I-94 right now. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I only wanted to comment, frankly, on the query that you put out to the listeners as to how we feel regarding the U.S. support for the war, quote unquote, in Ukraine. And I'm 100% behind not only the financial, but the weaponry that they need now at this juncture in the war, because it's, you know, it's changed. It's changed so much from when it was in Kyiv to where it is now. And that's what they really need, the HIMARS systems and the weaponry that actually goes along with that. Because it's not just one piece of equipment, it's a multiple set, you know. It's something that I was just listening to the section on Boris Johnson as well. I think if Wallace, the UK defense secretary, takes that job, I don't think the position will be a lot worse. And I understand Zelensky's disappointment in Johnson's resignation. I really do. But it isn't always from the top. It's got to be a unified front.
Got it. Glenn, thank you so much for the call. Lowell, looking at U.S. military support, this war could still go on for a while. Do we have a sense of how long U.S. support could last, could be there?
So far, the commitment from the United States has been strong. It continues to be strong, and I don't expect that to waver. I think it's one of the things that the Biden administration can point to as some real successes of getting Ukraine these weapons that they've been able to use. And certainly the Ukrainian military has outperformed what a lot of people were expecting at the beginning of the war. And I think the support from the United States and Europe is a part of that. Glenn's comment, by the way, about the HIMARS system is interesting. This is a really important new, relatively new weapon system, at least for Ukraine to have. The acronym is for High Mobility Artillery Rocket Systems. So these are precision and longer range. They use GPS to guide these rockets that are going in. And Ukraine's used them quite effectively. The point, though, that they still don't have a lot of these is correct, at least in terms of what they want. They've got around 12 systems, I believe, that at least are in the process of being delivered. A few of them they've been using already now. But to actually have equal footing with Russia to be able to just do whatever they wanted to against the Russians, you might need as many as 60 to 100 of those systems in place. And you know, we're not on pace to get them those. So, you know, it's certainly always more could be done. But again, I think we want to keep in mind the commitments so far from the United States of $7 billion in support, since February alone.
Thanks for that call, Glenn. Let's go next to Mary Kay in Kenosha. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi, I would like to see more diplomacy, like some of our news in Russia. Also, peace talks with Putin from NATO. And we have to keep helping Ukraine, with Doctors Without Borders and militarily. And to show Putin that if he opens up his border for trade and education and things, it's going to be way better than what he's doing to these people.
Mary Kay, thanks for the call. Lowell, what do you think about the prospect for more peace talks?
Well, I am always a supporter of diplomacy over fighting if it can work. There have been some talks, and there are actually some pretty interesting and important talks that started and then fell apart a bit. But on just something that sounds kind of basic, but in Russia and Ukraine trying to work together to get the grain in Ukraine out to the world. You know, we're facing this grain shortage and food crisis in parts of the world, partly because of this war. And Ukraine right now has around 22 million metric tons of grain that is stuck in silos and storage facilities because it can't get it out through the ports and things that it used to be able to use. So even something like that, if there can be an agreement between Ukraine and Russia, right, that those kinds of agreements can sometimes start the ball rolling toward bigger agreements. But getting to a negotiated settlement at the end of the war is really hard at this point. The centrality of identity in this war, this has been as much about identity as it has been about economics and even territory. And so, you know, Putin really feels like he needs a big victory at this point. And I think Zelensky can't be seen as sort of surrendering territory. So we're still at a place where finding that solution is hard through diplomacy. I think there is a territorial solution down the road that they may get to at some point. But I think, unfortunately, we are quite a ways from that. And we're looking at a minimum of months more of this conflict.
We heard from Tim in St. Germain, who couldn't stay on the line, but asked if Lowell, you think this could end in a division of territory like North Korea and South Korea. We, of course, had the invasion of Crimea in 2014. Is it possible that something like that could, there could be a division of territory that Tim is thinking about?
I mean, we've de facto had that a bit since 2014 in the sense of the areas in the far eastern parts of Ukraine that what were called the separatists, but with a lot of Russian help, had been controlling that territory de facto. And Crimea has essentially been incorporated into Russia now as a territorial unit. I think what's more likely is, and it would be hard for Ukraine to accept this, but I mean, that there will, in fact, be some sort of territorial concession in the east that at a minimum would include something like Luhansk and Donetsk entirely, maybe with a special status where they're not part of Russia. I think Russia will act to try to actually make them part of Russian territory. What's interesting about that, though, is for Ukraine long term, while it's devastating in terms of Ukrainian identity and it will be seen as something that's really politically very difficult for Zelensky to do, they will be more united and more European-looking and more Western-looking if Russia grabs those regions than if Russia were to leave them in Ukraine. And so I think that one of the interesting things to look at is if we think real long-term, as hard as it will be for Ukraine to want to accept this, that Ukraine itself, the population and the where the territory is, where there's kind of the most and least pro-Russian support, the loss of Donetsk and Luhansk would actually make Ukraine more united and more pro-Western and potentially even accelerate things, you know, like EU and NATO membership.
And Lowell, in our last minute, what is the factor that you have your eye on in the coming months?
I think whether the U.S. can and Europe can continue to get Ukraine more and more of these large weapon systems that can do a lot more damage the damage we've started to see in the last few weeks. Ukraine has hit a number of storage facilities and command centers with some of these new weapons, still in Ukraine, but doing a lot of damage to the Russian effort and slowing them down. And so I think that that's one thing to keep an eye on. The other thing, that people have talked about a bit, but is Putin's role in all this in terms of what, you know, maybe he does decide at some point that he's got enough of a victory. Maybe he does start pushing for more talks and things like that. I don't see that immediate. He hasn't indicated that as a likely thing in the near term. But at some point, he may decide that as his military still becomes, you know, more and more fatigued, even with this new focus on the East, that it would be time for talks. So we can perhaps at least hope that that could happen.
Lowell, thanks as always for joining us.
And thank you.
Lowell Barrington is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. He was with us to talk about the latest in the war on Ukraine.